Call for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's the director of WUSA 9 Call for Action and your host, Shirley Rooker.
Do you understand the so-called Doc Fix Bill? What about the Nationwide Health Information Network? Should you be concerned about the privacy of your medical records and, even more importantly, about the security of those records? Well, these are some of the issues we're going to discuss today. My guest is Twyla Braze. She is the co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and she's also certified public health nurse. So Twyla, you know whereof you speak because you've been in the medical field for a number of years. You were a practicing nurse at one time, am I correct?
That's correct. Yes, I was in an emergency room, a pediatric emergency room nurse.
Okay. And then how did you, what prompted you to get so interested in health freedom and choice and security? I mean, they're something that concern all of us, but you've really now devoting your, I guess, full time to working on some of these issues and where you see concerns?
Well, several things happened. One, I watched President Clinton offer us all a health security card in a law that would also create a national health information network for all of our data. That was one reason. And the other was that that particular law and laws that came after it has been working to move all of our healthcare options into managed care, where outsiders have more control over what kind of care we can get, and they use our data to limit our physicians and limit our access to patient care. So all of that helped to start the organization and to continue our works to address all of that, because we really want patients and doctors to be in charge of medical decisions, and we want the price to come down for most healthcare, down to the pocketbook, but yet still have a catastrophic coverage for those medical needs that you can't possibly save for.
Right. Okay, we're going to talk about that. Now, how long has the Citizens Council for Health Freedom been in existence?
This is our 21st year.
Wow.
So it's been quite a while.
I think you're going to be around for a while. Good for you.
Maybe.
And you're joining us from Minnesota, am I correct?
That's correct. We are based in Minnesota, but we work at both the state and the national level and in Minnesota, as well as helping organizations and groups in other states. And then we also come to Washington, D.C. and speak with members of Congress about issues that we think they should understand perhaps better than they do today.
Okay. Now, let's talk about what I alluded to in the intro, what's the so-called Doc Fix Bill. Now, your organization has expressed some major concerns about this bill, which has already, I guess, been enacted into law. Tell us what, as consumers, we should be concerned about, or from your viewpoint, what are the things that you all are addressing?
Well, it was called the Doc Fix Bill because it changes the way that doctors are paid. And doctors were scheduled to get a 21% cut in Medicare payments. And this has been something that has been going on for several years. And Congress always delayed these cuts and delayed them as they grew and grew and grew. And finally, they decided to repeal that law that allowed those cuts to go forward. So those cuts are no longer happening, but they have substituted it with two new payment systems that we believe are going to lead doctors to start rationing care to their patients as a way to be to maintain their own financial stability. And so one of those ways is called an alternative payment methodology, which in short means that doctors would get an annual lump sum payment to take care of a group of patients. That means they get paid once for the entire year and have to divvy out those monies across the year, never knowing who was going to walk through their door or how expensive that person would be. Therefore, they're going to have to look at every patient over the entire year to decide what kind of spending they want to do on that patient, because they never know who is coming next. So that's one of the reasons we believe that they will start rationing care. The other one is called the merit-based payment system, or MIPS, and that is going to judge every physician according to their performance, according to the way government says they should perform, which may or may not be how patients think that they should perform. For instance, how many resources do they use? So how much care and how much money do they spend? They'll be judged on that, and according to the scores, they could end up with as much as a 9% penalty in Medicare payments. So we think that both of these things will lead to doctors being less focused on the patients and more focused on the payment, and therefore will start doing rationing just to make sure that they aren't dinged by the Medicare administration.
Okay, now I understand the first part where you say there's going to be a limited amount of money given to a doctor, and that's going to be used to cover the health care that's provided by that doctor to all of their Medicare patients over the course of a year. Am I correct on that?
Correct.
Okay, so we can see how that would lead. We can see how that would lead, perhaps lead to limiting services. It depends on how much is being given. But now let's go to the second part where you're talking about an incentive kind of thing here. This to me is rather fuzzy. How do and what kind of criteria is going to be used to determine a doctor's performance? That worries me.
Right. So there are four factors, and let's see if I can remember them because I'm not actually looking at the paper at the moment. But the first one is quality. And government gets to decide what quality means and how it's defined. So today, for instance, a doctor can be judged on the basis of whether the patient quit smoking. Now, of course, the doctor has nothing to do with the patient quitting smoking. But if the patient doesn't quit smoking, the doctor gets a lower quality score. So that's just one example of how the government and health plans score quality and how they define quality.
Okay, let's just follow this through here for a minute. So let's say I smoke.
Yeah.
And I go to my doctor and he's trying to convince me to stop smoking. I don't smoke,
right.
But suppose he's trying to convince me to stop smoking and I don't pay any attention to him. So
Right. You're
telling me that the doctor is going to be penalized in terms of payment to him, even though he's seen me and rendered the services to me that he should have, then he's not going to get payment. He may be penalized if he has a number of smokers.
That's correct. So it depends on how the number, usually it's a percentage, so that a certain percentage of their smokers have quit smoking or a percentage of their patients don't smoke. So if they've got a higher than that so-called quality percentage, then they will end up with a lower quality score.
And then the same thing would probably be true if you have obese patients. Would this?
Anything could happen. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has almost 4,000 quality measures to choose from, but different health plans and Medicare make different decisions about which exact ones they want the doctor to follow. So some of the most common ones today that they follow are the smoking one, or whether or not the patient takes aspirin after they get to a certain age to prevent heart conditions. Another one is that the blood pressure stays within a certain range, or that the cholesterol level stays within a certain range, or that the blood sugar stays within a certain range. And if it is outside of that range, then the doctor gets a lower score. But of course, it's the patient who determines
what those things are actually going to be.
Even the patient's genetics. They may not get their cholesterol down.
Right. Let's just take a brief pause here to let our listeners know they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Twyla Braze. She is the co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and she's also a certified public health nurse. And we're discussing about the bill that recently went through Congress on payments to doctors and how that is under Medicare and how that's going to change. Well, following this through, Twyla, on this whole business of the genetic factors, for example. So suppose genetically your family has breast cancer and or some other kind of disease. The doctor has no control of that. How is and I'm assuming this is all going to be done by computer and by the way the doctor reports it. Is that true? Or, I mean, who's going to monitor this and make all these decisions? It boggles my mind, I have to tell you.
Yes. So part of Obamacare, along with this Doc Fix bill, it requires certain quality measurements being reported to the federal government. So they use the electronic health record system to decide which of these factors are reported, and they have to have, the clinics and hospitals have to have entire staffs to make sure that this kind of data that's required for full payment is actually sent to the government and sent to the health plans. So health plans do the very same thing. Private health plans do the very same thing as Medicare is doing. So, yes, that's what happens. It gets taken out of the electronic medical record, or it could also be sent by paper if there's a physician or a clinician that doesn't yet have an electronic health record.
Okay, now, is this going to, and I don't wish to disparage doctors, I love my doctors, but Is this going to encourage doctors to be extremely selective in the patients they actually see?
Well, it's possible, depending on how hard this gets ratcheted down, because if you look at the other things that are on this merit-based payment system, so I said that there's quality measurement, right?
Right.
And that's really more about compliance. It's about the patient, not so much the doctor, but the doctor is the one that's being judged. But the second part is resource use. So they have to report how many healthcare resources they used, and that's going to be 30% of their score.
Now, what do you mean by health resources? Explain that to me. I don't understand it.
Well, it's not actually in the bill, and I think it is yet to be defined. But
okay.
It means how many services they've provided, how much money has been spent. How are they spending their money? How many different kind of, well, whatever they decide, whatever the government decides that a resource is what they're going to have to report, how much of it they spent or used. So it's really about measuring the total use of services and then potentially dinging a doctor, giving him demerits if he uses too much. Well, because all of this is about cost containment.
Yeah, this is a little bit astonishing to me in terms of the record keeping. I'm sitting here thinking, oh my goodness, hundreds of millions of people, medical records,
right.
Going into a national database. Are we going to be certain that all that information is secure and will we be able to be identified in that database?
Well, I think that's yet to be determined. They can possibly put it in aggregated form, and yet they'll have to make their records available to the Department of Health and Human Services or to the health plan if they want to come in and validate that those were actually the correct numbers of resource use or the correct scoring of quality or one of the other factors is whether or not they use electronic health records. So if they don't use an electronic health record, they're automatically docked. I'm not sure how much. It might be 10 or 15%. I can't quite remember. So that their score is less if they don't use electronic health records. But, of course, you know, electronic health records do many things, including increasingly exposing people to unsafe conditions. There's more and more talk about the fact that injury can come because of health information technology and this whole move to make everything electronic and computerized.
Well, we've already heard cases, Twyla, of people having their medical identity stolen so that you go into a hospital and somebody else's health record is there. I mean, this has been going on for some time. And are you saying that this possibility is going to be enhanced? I mean, there's going to be more and more of this kind of thing happening. And that's where you can have damage, because if somebody else is taking one kind of medicine and it's in your health record, and you don't even know that it's been hijacked, that could be devastating.
Yes, there are all sorts of possible dangers. For instance, there's an amazing report about a 16-year-old who got a dose of Septra. That's a typical antibiotic, but he got a dose of Septra that was 38 and a half times too much.
Oh, my goodness.
Too much. He went into grand mal seizure, quit breathing. He did manage to survive.
Thank God.
It had simply been an incorrect number that had been put into the record. And the electronic health record is very easy to, you know, you just have all these different fields, right? If you put it into the wrong field or the fields are really close and you think it's one thing and not the other thing. So there's that kind of thing happening. And a litigation expert just recently in Politico said that he thinks that the United States will have to create an injury compensation fund to compensate those who actually get harmed, physically harmed, by the electronic health record. I mean, that's one incident, but there's also the thing like happened, I can't remember which hospital or even what state this was in, where the EHR system shut down for 2 weeks. This is the hospital EHR system. And so here they all were clamoring, trying to figure out how to keep track of things on paper and how to start it all up again because it crashed. The system crashed,
goodness,
and it was gone for two weeks. And that includes all the ICU patients. That includes all the computerized order entry to order treatment. All of that suddenly gone.
That must have been a catastrophe. My gracious. Well, now, Will patients have any control over this information? Will they have any access to see what's in medical records? I know there's been a big controversy on the state level that states maintain records, but most states maintain that that's an aggregated data, that it's not identifiable. But right now, I think a patient has a right to see what's maintained in their medical files. Will that right continue?
I believe that right will continue, but the extent to which a person even knows about that right or how easily it is to access it, I think those may be things that might have to be worked out. But there are certain times when even under HIPAA, you can't get access to your medical records. For instance, if they think you're going to sue, they have a right to withhold access. Or if they think it could harm you psychologically, they have a right to withhold it until you have somebody else with you to look at the data. There are those kind of stipulations where you may not be able to get access. Or if you have a family member, like if you're the wife and you want to see your husband's records, now in that case, unless he has said that you can or someone decides that you can, they won't give you access. Sometimes even if he says you can, they won't give you access. And a lot of people are complaining about that.
Yeah, because that might be where the spouse is the partial caregiver. So let's just take a brief pause here, Twyla, and let our listeners know that they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Twyla Braze. She is the co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. She is also a certified public health nurse. And we're talking about concerns about medical privacy. Now, all the things that we've been discussing so far under the Doc Fix, I guess we should be clear. That pertains to people who are under Medicare. Is that correct?
Yes, however.
And no.
yes and no. Because what happens, as most people in healthcare know, whatever Medicare does, everyone follows.
Uh-huh.
So it's really difficult for doctors to run two separate systems. So oftentimes it happens that the two of them, that everything runs the same way because of how that law changes.
Okay. So really, all people should be aware and keyed into this. Now, you mentioned something that I think that most people have a mistaken impression. Tell us what HIPAA is and whether it really protects our privacy, because it's often referred to as the Patient Privacy Act, but it isn't, is it?
No, it's actually the Patient Open All of Your Medical Records Act.
Which is, and I think that's a well-kept secret, because I think most people, when they go into the doctor's office and they see this form on patient privacy, they're not really signing anything saying, I want privacy. They're signing something that says, you can share this information with whomever you wish, just about.
Well, actually what they're signing is, I know that you are able to, by law, share anything with whoever you want to without my say-so.
Mm-hmm.
Because the form that they're signing says, I have read or I have understood or I have seen or I have been offered the notice of patient privacy practices. But that particular notice, if you actually take the time to look at it, what you'll see is that there's no privacy in it at all. It is all the places that your information can be disclosed
right.
Without your consent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, HIPAA is what allowed all of your data to be put online in electronic health records in computerized form without your consent, because HIPAA is very permissive as to the sharing of your data by whoever has it.
Well, it's astonishing to me when people start talking about, well, I can't give you information because of HIPAA. That's not true at all, is it?
Well, there are certain places that they can give information and certain that they can't. And so there are reasons why certain people can't get access to that information because of HIPAA. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if a health plan, for instance, has all sorts of business partners, if they can mm-hmm. give all that data to all those business partners under HIPAA. And so, you know, it can be sent to all of these companies. It can be sent hither and yon, but you may not be able to get it.
Well, now, let me ask you this, just to follow this a little bit further. If I go into my doctor's office and they ask me to sign this form and I say, no, I'm not going to sign it, what's going to happen? Can the doctor refuse me treatment?
Some doctors will refuse you treatment because they are afraid of the HIPAA penalties. However, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has a website to tell doctors and hospitals what to do when you refuse to sign the HIPAA form. We actually have a wallet-sized card that patients can take in and use to give that URL, that website, to the administrator so that they can see that they do not have to sign this form. By law, they do not have to sign this form.
Okay, now, Twyla, you got to tell me where we get this, because I bet our listeners are thinking, okay, I may want to have one of those forms.
All they have to do is go online or give us a call. So online at C, they can go to www.cchfreedom.org and simply use the email link to ask for it, and we will send them one. If they want a whole packet, we'd like a donation, but if they want just one, we're happy to send them one.
Right.
If they want to call, they can call 651-646-8935 and simply ask for the HIPAA wallet card.
Repeat that number for us.
651-646-8935. And by the way, if they have a story about what happens when they use that card or when they say no to signing the form, we have a special story button on our homepage that we would love them to share that story for us to use as to how HIPAA is actually working around the country and whether or not people are able to exercise this right to refuse to sign. And while they're there, they can go up to our e-news and click and get our weekly e-news. It's right at the very top of the homepage.
And the website is cchfreedom.org. You're a nonprofit organization. Your phone number is 651-646-8935. And if you're interested in that, you know, some people don't really care. I have to say I have mixed emotions about privacy because I don't think we really have any anymore. So I wonder how much we can fight the battle. But what do you recommend to patients, Twyla, to help protect themselves? For example, when we were talking about errors in medical programs, my husband and I both usually have at home records of our medicines and anything like that. Should we always carry that with us? I mean, what if we end up in an accident, we end up in the hospital and they have wrong information in a medical file?
Right. And so they certainly could have wrong information, or it's just been entered wrong or never deleted,
right,
and they think
right,
you're on medications that you aren't. So I think that's a fine idea to do that. I would also be careful about any questionnaire that they ask you about, particularly if it has nothing to do with your current visit.
Mm-hmm.
Why provide all that information for all sorts of outsiders to parse through?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can have other people who know where these lists of medications are, or you can get copies of your medical records
mm-hmm.
yourself and keep them and bring certain ones with you wherever you go. You can get your medical records on a flash drive that your doctor could use if you were out of state, for instance.
Yeah, or if you're traveling abroad, that might be very useful too. Yeah, because you're always concerned. As we get older, the concerns grow, you know, whether we have health issues or not. There's certainly some record of anything that we have that might be of concern. All right, we're just about out of time, Twyla. As usual, it's great to have you. Again, let's give the information for your website, if you would, please.
Sure. The website is www.cchfreedom.org. And at the very top is our e-news, which comes out every Wednesday with a commentary from me.
All right. Well, we look forward to talking to you again, Twyla. It's great of you to take the time. I know you've been very busy in some of the issues that we're working on. I'm so glad to have you with us. To our listeners, we have been talking about some of the Doc Fix bill and some of the things that you need to be concerned about or aware of. And we'll just have to see how it shakes out because, as Twyla had mentioned, many things are yet to be defined. And you have been listening to Of Consuming Interest right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Shirley Rooker. If you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at shirley@callforaction.org. Thank you for joining us.
of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by WUSA 9 Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.